I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. 10 years ago this summer, the Rome Statute was enacted, creating the International Criminal Court, the ICC. It's the world's first permanent tribunal whose goal is to end impunity for the perpetrators of genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity. In its first decade, it has convicted just one person, Congolese warlord Thomas Lubanga, found guilty in March of recruiting and using child soldiers. More than 120 countries have joined the court, but not the United States or China or Russia. Today on Radio Times, we evaluate the court's first decade and look ahead to the second. And we have three guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studios, including Ambassador Stephen Rapp, Ambassador at Large, heading up the Office of Global Criminal Justice in the U.S. Department of State, helping to formulate U.S. policy on mass atrocities. He previously served as prosecutor of the Special Court for Sierra Leone and served as senior trial attorney and chief of prosecutions at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. Ambassador Stephen Rapp, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good to be here, Marty.
Also with us is Ambassador Christian Venevaeser, and he has been a permanent representative of the Principality of Liechtenstein to the UN since 2002, was president of the Assembly of States Parties to the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court, and he served as chairman of the Special Working Group on the Crime of Aggression. Ambassador Venevaeser, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as
well. Morning,
Marty. And rounding out our trio of guests is John Washburn, convener of the American Non-Governmental Organizations Coalition for the International Criminal Court, co-chair of the Washington Working Group on the International Criminal Court, and a past president of the Unitarian Universalist United Nations Office. I should also add he spent many years as an American diplomat and a UN official. And John Washburn, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Great to be with you, Marty.
Nice to have all three of you with us. And if I could begin with you, Christian Venevaeser, why do we need the International Criminal Court?
Well, it's the one court that helps us fill a gap that has existed really since the end of World War II, namely a court that steps in if and when national courts do not do their job. And as we all know, that has happened time and again, and it has always been the worst perpetrators of the most serious crimes that have gotten away with it. So I think we have filled the most serious gap in international law by establishing the court.
Stephen Rapp, do you see it as a court of last resort?
Well, indeed, and as a court of last resort, in principle, this is what the United States supports. I do keep in mind that in the period after the end of the Cold War, the international community formed a number of other tribunals that people are, I think, more familiar with, those that tried the Yugoslavian war criminals like President Milosevic, and they're trying Ratko Mladic, the general that led the Srebrenica massacre, according to the evidence. There have been those kinds of courts, but they've been for one-off kind of situations, the former Yugoslavia, Rwanda, Sierra Leone, Cambodia, and this is an international court that could deal with situations anywhere in the world. There were, however, provisions in the treaty that concerned the United States. The United States is not yet a member, but in this administration, following up on moves toward the court in the closing years of the Bush administration, we're engaging with the court and supporting it in its prosecutions.
And I want to pick up on that. Let me turn to you, John Washburn. When we talk about crimes against humanity, genocide, war crimes, what are we talking about?
Well, you're talking about crimes that have been well established as atrocity crimes since the Nuremberg Tribunal. And in a very important way, the court is a legacy of Nuremberg. And when I talk with Americans about the court and our relationship with it, which is my job, that connection with Nuremberg gets a very strong response. These are three categories of crimes were well established in different ways, but very strongly established in international law when the negotiations to create the court began, so that it was a question basically of taking existing international law, which applied to the behavior of states, and modifying that so that it could be applied to the criminal behavior of specific individuals. And that's really what makes the core of the court's work. It's also, I think, important to point out that although all three of those categories cover a very wide range of crimes from small to atrocious, the court is empowered to try only the worst people for the worst crimes.
Let me pick up on what you were saying earlier, Stephen Rapp, about the U.S. and its relationship with the ICC. Clinton signed the Rome Statute back in 2000. He, interestingly, did not submit it to the Senate for ratification. President Bush then unsigned the treaty. What is the Obama administration's relationship with the ICC? How do you see that relationship?
Well, it's engagement with the court. We're beginning in 2009. We took up the position as observers in the ICC assembly and participate as we can in the debates. We also look at the cases that have been filed by the court. We do have this law that passed in 2002, the American Service Members Protection Act, that restricts some of what we can do. But there's a provision in it that says on a case-by-case basis we can provide in-kind assistance to the court. And we've looked at these cases and found in every situation that it's possible for us to help, because it's responding to situations that cry out for justice, mass murder and rape in the Congo, the crimes committed by the Lord's Resistance Army in Uganda, Joseph Kony and others. These are situations where there is no ability of national systems to prosecute these high-level individuals, and these are not ambiguous crimes. These are crimes in which the targets are the innocent. They're not targeting soldiers. They're targeting men, women, and children, soft targets, and committing crimes against humanity, war crimes, and in some cases, genocide.
Let me turn back to you, Christian Benevaser. Does it hurt the court that the U.S. is not an official signer of that treaty?
Well, you know, for us, it's from the perspective of the states who are part of the treaty, it's more important to have a positive engagement by the United States. And that's the way I approached it when I was the president of the assembly. It's a decision of the U.S. Congress in the end whether or not the U.S. joins, and I don't see that happening very soon. But for us, that was extremely important, to have a positive engagement, and I think we have made very good steps in this respect. There's a huge gap of 8 years. You know, if a country disengages for 8 years, that country comes back, and there is just a lot to catch up on. And that is the work that commenced in 2009, while it has to be said that, you know, the Bush administration at the end already changed its approach vis-a-vis the court, but it did not come back to work with us in the assembly. So there's a huge gap that was to make up for. And I think we are in principle on a good way. So for me, it never has been the key thing whether or not the United States is there, because I don't think that's a realistic goal for the immediate future.
Even though it sounds like the U.S. in many ways supports the goal, the mission of the ICC.
Well, you know, the U.S. can be extremely important and perhaps the most important partner of the court in helping investigations and also helping arrests. And that is what we are hoping to see much more in the future, because this court has suffered from a lack of arrests, it has suffered from what we have done as states. And the U.S. can play a crucial role in this respect, and we're hoping to see much more of that in the future.
Let me turn to you, John Washburn. For the critics of the court in the United States, one of the concerns was that the U.S. would give up some kind of jurisdiction to an international court, that Americans might actually be prosecuted for war crimes. Is that a legitimate concern, you think?
Well, the facts are that, indeed, right now, an American could be prosecuted by the court if that American went to a country which was a member state of the court and committed an atrocity there. Sometimes Americans have trouble remembering this, something that I learned very vividly when I was a consular officer. It is difficult for Americans to take in psychologically and emotionally, even though they grant it, understand it intellectually, that if, as an American, you go to another country, you become subject to the law of that country. So there is that difficulty that we have to deal with, although eventually you reach people because they understand that rationally. There is a concern about American sovereignty.
Right.
The counterargument to that is that the U.S. belongs to a great many international organizations, and that belonging to an international organization is a calculation you make as to whether what you get from that organization is more than what you give up to join it. And it is that argument that we have to engage in over and over again. in my work as a champion of the cause of the court inside the United States. I think the main difficulty that a lot of Americans have is the notion of international law applying to individuals, even though this was a cause that we championed at Nuremberg and that we championed in the temporary tribunals for Rwanda and Yugoslavia. But those, as Ambassador Rapp has reminded us, were one-off situations in which the United States was not really engaged in anything that could be part of the atrocities committed there.
Let me go back to you, Stephen Rapp, and even thinking about the work that you did serving on the special court for Sierra Leone, also the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. The ICC is in The Hague. It's not obviously headquartered in these various countries. What's gained, what's lost by having the ICC in The Hague?
Well, I mean, let me talk about what's lost. Obviously, you'd like to have the trials as close as possible to the scene of the crime, to where the victims are, to where the affected communities are. But many times these societies have been devastated. Their judiciaries, members, judges, lawyers, others slaughtered or sent abroad, fleeing abroad, and there isn't an immediate capacity to do it, and there may not be security. In the case of the Rwanda Tribunal, we tried those cases 500 miles from Rwanda over in Tanzania for security. In the Freetown case, in the case of Sierra Leone, we actually established the court at the scene of the crime in Sierra Leone and tried 10 people there. But then because of security concerns by some of the regional leaders, when we finally got Liberian President Charles Taylor, we were requested to move him and to try him elsewhere. And so we went up to the ICC, actually, and used the ICC as our venue. They weren't yet doing trials, and so we were able for a couple years to use their courtroom before we moved into another facility in The Hague. There was a disadvantage in being that far from the scene of the crime. We had to bring witnesses thousands of miles. We had to make sure that people in Sierra Leone and Liberia had access to the case. So you lose something, of course, you gain a greater security, you gain greater visibility.
Well, let's take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about the International Criminal Court, the ICC. And our guests are actually speaking later this afternoon at the Free Library of Philadelphia's main branch. That's at 1901 Vine Street, part of the Philadelphia Global Initiative on the Rule of Laws Conference. And it's this afternoon from 2 until 6. They obviously join us today on Radio Times as we assess and evaluate and discuss the International Criminal Court. The voice you just heard is Ambassador Stephen Rapp, also with us, Ambassador Christian Veneveser and John Washburn. We're going to take some calls after this very short break. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Foundation supports WHYY. Since 1918, the Philadelphia Foundation has enhanced culture and recreation. The foundation helps strengthen nonprofit organizations that support the arts, provide recreational opportunities, sustain the environment, and promote multicultural connections. The foundation can help you make a difference for such southeastern Pennsylvania nonprofits today and forever while you receive tax deductions. The Philadelphia Foundation, 215-563-6417 or philafound.org.
In 30 years after Black Flag, singer Keith Morris still records albums the punk way.
You set up, you put the mics in front of the equipment, and you rock out. You don't think about it, you just do it.
Keith and the punk supergroup Off perform live in the studio this week on Sound Opinions.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
Family members of the young men and women who join this service expect them to put their lives on the line for the country, but they don't expect them to take their own lives after brutal hazing, like the nephew of Congresswoman Judy Chu. Now she's leading the fight to stop it.
We have to protect those who protect us.
She'll tell us more next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. We are talking about the International Criminal Court, the ICC. It celebrated its 10th anniversary this summer, and we are joined by Ambassador Stephen Rapp, leads the U.S. State Department's Office of Global Criminal Justice, Ambassador Christian Venevaeser, permanent representative of Liechtenstein to the U.N. and former president of the Assembly of States Parties to the ICC, and John L. Washburn, convener of the American Non-Governmental Organization Coalition for the International Criminal Court. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Christian Venevaeser, let me ask you about the fact, and I said in my introduction, just one person has been convicted. This is the Congolese warlord, Thomas Lubanga, found guilty earlier this year of recruiting and using child soldiers. Looking at the fact that the court's been in an existence for 10 years, is that a cause for celebration, or does it raise questions that only one person has been convicted?
Well, I know it's the first case was very important for the court, so it was very important that it did result in a conviction and that due process was observed. You also have to factor in, of course, that there was a startup phase in establishing the court in 2002, which is, you know, the point of time that you're talking about. You know, people were talking about buying computers and doing things like that. So there was a startup phase. That said, I think it did take a long time, yes. And states parties were getting impatient, and we all expect that there were certain lessons learned during this first trial that will be applied in the future.
Such as?
There were a lot of difficulties in the proceedings, the use of intermediaries, the use of evidence, of classified evidence, which led to very significant delays. And we really expect that this is not going to repeat itself in the future, so we will see more expeditious trials while, you know, the right of the defendant and due process are still fully observed. So there is a clear expectation there.
Who's the next person to be tried?
Well, there's several persons on trial right now. Mr. Bemba, the former vice president of the DRC, and again, from
the Democratic
Republic of the Congo. Yes, sorry. And also other persons from the Congo. So there's different trials going on now in parallel at the same time.
I saw you give an enthusiastic nod, John Washburn, when Christian Venevaeser was saying lessons learned from this first trial. You agree?
Yes, I do. And there are a great many of them. Whenever you do something for the first time, you learn a lot of things about how to get it right. You have surprises that set you back. Anybody who's tried to assemble a bicycle on Christmas evening knows that.
Yes.
that's what happened in this case. This case produced a verdict of some 600 pages, not because the judges enjoyed being verbose, but because they were aware of all of the different things that they had resumed, that they had resolved. Many of these issues had to go up on appeals to the appeals chamber and had to be finally settled there and then sent back to the trial chamber. While those appeals were underway, the trial chamber had to suspend proceedings. The verdict includes, as Ambassador Venevaeser has said, all kinds of issues having to do with due process that Americans would immediately recognize as critical. It also deals with things like paying reparations to victims. How do you do that? Who's to do it? What's the organization to do it? What are the criteria? There's a whole long section on that. So it has been long. As Ambassador Venevaeser said, you have to start running the clock when the court first opened for business. I happened to be in the building during that initial few weeks, and there was nothing. There was no furniture, nothing. There's this very nice building that had been given made available by the host country, the Netherlands. But this was something that was really started absolutely from scratch. And I really want to emphasize the point that he made, that this was creating something new and that there was nothing there when they began. So I would take off of this 10-year period, I'd take off at least 4 to 5 years for the court simply getting itself ready to work.
Let me turn to you, Stephen Rapp. And one of the criticisms of the ICC is that those people who have been indicted are Africans or are from African countries. Does that say that from the ICC's perspective, that the kinds of war crimes and crimes against humanity and genocide is only happening in Africa?
Well, during the particular period that we're talking about, since the court came in 2002, if you're looking for where incidents have occurred of mass killings and rapes and intentional targeting of civilians, this is where people are being victimized. And this is a recognition of the victims and their rights to demand justice that these cases are brought. In the 90s, it wasn't necessarily that case. And indeed, if you look at the record of international justice since the Cold War, the Yugoslavia tribunals brought 161 people to justice, every one of the people that it charged that they've been successful in bringing in. Those are not Africans. They're all Europeans. The Rwanda tribunal dealing rather with a horrendous genocide, the murder of 800,000 people in 100 days in 94, has brought 83 people to justice. But if you look at the whole picture, you'll discover that the number is actually a majority of people that have been brought to justice are from outside Africa. I remember when the Rwanda tribunal was established, people were saying, after because the Yugoslavia one had been set up the previous year, well, what about the victims in Africa? Aren't they entitled to justice too? And that's one of the reasons the U.S. went to the Rwanda tribunal. Now we have a situation where you have these victims in Africa, and they are receiving justice. Now, the perpetrators and their allies, and sometimes big men with great power and wealth who are committing these crimes, they complain about it, and their defense teams do. But these are trials based upon where the crimes are committed.
Let me turn back to you, Christian Venevaeser, the name Joseph Kony, the Lord's Resistance Army, mentioned here, and he's someone that the ICC has indicted. But the ICC doesn't have a police force or an army. He is somewhere in East Africa. I know that there are some U.S. special forces there looking for him. Does that limit, though, what the ICC can do if you don't have, in a sense, a police force to go get these people?
Well, in a sense, it does. But I think, in a sense, it also simply shows that, you know, this is not just a court. The way a court usually operates, it requires us to work with the court. So it cannot function without us as the states. And the ones who have the competence and the authority to arrest people are national police forces. So we have to do our job. So I think a big challenge we're facing is to get states to do their part of the work instead of just looking at the court and saying, you know, this is too slow and this is too expensive and this is what have you. So we have to do our work. And that also goes to your previous question. The answer to your question, of course, is no. These crimes are not only committed in Africa, but this court is not set up to investigate each and every crime around the globe. The main philosophy behind this court is to get national judiciaries to do their own jobs. So if a war crime is committed in my country, we put that person on trial, then the court has no business dealing with it. That's the principle of complementarity. And as you said earlier on, this is a court of last resort. Mm-hmm. So the important thing is for us to do our work.
Well, let me turn back to you, John Washburn, then we'll get some callers into the conversation. Again, helping us understand the relationship between the U.S. and the ICC. Is Joseph Kony a good example of that? And by that, I mean he's been indicted by the ICC, and the U.S. does have, allegedly, reportedly, special forces there looking for Joseph Kony.
Well, it's an interesting example. This, you are right in pointing out that this is the first situation in which we've actually had the United States commit military people as part of an effort to get Kony. They aren't really special forces groups. They are experts who help the Ugandan military forces and others to improve their skills in finding Kony, and they also lend a certain amount of technical support, and they interact with the government's technical information that it can provide to those who are chasing Kony. From another angle, we of course all know about this incredible internet piece, video about Kony that went viral and had several million hits around the world in
Indeed.
A matter of hours.
Indeed.
This shows something very important, which is that if you can make a situation real to people around the world, and including in the United States, it attracts very favorable attention by people everywhere to the court, and including in the United States. And we have a phenomenon in the United States now where conservatives in Congress and elsewhere are participating in measures designed to push the U.S. government to do more in specific case situations. And the Coney one is a particular example of that.
You want to add to that, Stephen?
Yeah,
Rappius,
just
go ahead.
And clearly, as John said, what we're doing in the Coney search is aiding African militaries and security forces in this effort. And we're hopeful that that Coney will soon be brought to justice, and the other two individuals that have also been charged by the ICC. But John refers to some issues in Congress that are interesting. We have a rewards program for war crimes. It's administered by my office since I became ambassador 3 years ago. We've paid out 14 rewards. They've been up to $2 million for the arrest and transfer of people to the Yugoslavia and Rwanda tribunals. The law only permits us to pay for those, but there's legislation in Congress with strong bipartisan support from the furthest right to the furthest left that would allow this to pay a reward for anyone wanted in an international or mixed or hybrid court. Of course, we'd have to give notice to Congress of the persons that we were going to add, and there'd have to be a decision across the U.S. government that it was appropriate. But this legislation has passed the House. It's before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee tomorrow. And we're hopeful that that this legislation could pass even before the election break, in which case, I can't say for sure, but I'm pretty confident we'd move ahead rather quickly to include Joseph Kony and the other two individuals, Ungwen and Odhiambo, and potentially look at other situations. And it's an example of political support that we do find in the United States, that when you talk about individual crimes and people being raped and murdered in the Congo or Uganda or in Cote d'Ivoire or Sierra Leone, people in America are very, very concerned. When Charles Taylor was on the loose after his, we alleged, supporting and aiding and abetting mass war crimes in Sierra Leone, amputation and rape and everything else, we got a resolution through Congress, I think 424-1, calling for his arrest and transfer.
Yeah,
so these are things that you can build support around, and so that's what we're working on.
And that's Ambassador Stephen Rapp. He leads the U.S. State Department's Office of Global Criminal Justice. Also with us, Ambassador Christian Venevaeser, a permanent representative of Liechtenstein to the U.N. and former president of the Assembly of States Parties of the ICC, and John L. Washburn, convener for the American Non-Governmental Organizations Coalition for the International Criminal Court. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get to Enid from Philadelphia to join our conversation. And Enid, go ahead. You're on the air. And you got to turn your phone down there, Enid.
What?
Yeah, go ahead. You're on the air, Enid. Turn your phone down, please.
Okay.
Please.
Yes.
All right, we're going to put you on hold only because it's very distracting to hear the phone in the background. We'll get back to you. Let me put something to you, Christian Venevaeser. Looking at Syria,
mm-hmm.
And it's very complicated, obviously, and very troubling what's going on inside Syria. Mm. Is that something that the ICC could and should take a look at?
Well, it cannot right now because Syria is not a party to the Rome Statute. It's not a court that has universal reach yet. It only has automatic jurisdiction in those countries that have accepted the Rome Statute. But it could, if the Security Council of the United Nations decided to refer the situation to the ICC, which it has done in the case of Darfur. It has also done so in the case of Libya. There has been a bit of a discussion on this, but given the really dismal state of diplomacy concerning Syria, this discussion has never gone very far. Everybody knows at this point that atrocious crimes are committed in Syria, that crimes against humanity are committed in Syria by the regime. There's certainly crimes committed also by the opposition. It is an awful situation, and nothing is being done about it. The only strong message that could come right now is for the Security Council to say, this should be investigated by the ICC in the absence, obviously, of a functioning national judiciary. And personally, I think it would be an extremely important message to send you know, to say, yes, we want a political solution to this. Yes, this is a threat to international peace and security, to regional stability. But there must be accountability for these awful, awful crimes that have been documented, and there will be much more coming out, and that's a really awful situation.
Let me go back to the phones, and we'll try Enid again. Enid, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, hi.
Hi there.
This is Enid Adler from Philadelphia, and I'm advisor to the American Bar Association Center for Human Rights. Question, I just would like to follow up a little bit on the principle of complementarity. That seems to be one of the biggest concerns in the U.S., that we would be dragged before the court. And that was one thing that the U.S. wanted to have in the treaty, which was in their meaning that we have primacy if it's one of our people that might be, for some reason, investigated or brought before the court, so that it wouldn't get to the court. But our courts were willing and able to do this. So I thought it was important if you could follow up.
Sure.
On that, please.
Enid, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Can I put it to you, Stephen Rapp?
Well, indeed. I mean, the principle of complementarity, this idea that the state's responsible and the state prosecutes its own, is something we believe in strongly in the United States. If someone commits a war crime like this horrible case of allegedly the Sergeant Bales, who killed a lot of civilians in Afghanistan a few months ago, we proceed with that in our military justice system. And indeed, our military justice system is recognized as one of the strongest in the world. And an American who was involved in the ICC process, Bill Lietzau, who's a career Marine prosecutor and now a Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense, was actively involved in writing the Article 8 of the ICC statute on war crimes and the elements of crimes, and that was because we have such an experience in doing these cases ourselves. Other members of the ICC, the UK, Australia, they've had situations where their individuals have committed war crimes in Iraq or Afghanistan, and they've proceeded to prosecute these individuals in their own system, and that meant the ICC didn't have to touch them. And so that does give, I think, a greater assurance to people that if we were to be part of this court, we wouldn't face any risk, because we'd step up and do it ourselves.
About 45 seconds before our second break here, John.
Right, very quickly. The problem with complementarity, which is, as the ambassador has said, a very, very powerful and important principle in the court for which the U.S. can take a lot of credit, the difficulty with making an argument based on the complementarity effective in the United States is simply that there is a very low level of trust among a considerable segment of the American population in any international organization. Therefore, people who feel that way say we can't trust the judges of the court to apply complementarity fairly to the United States. I'm pleased to say that this is an attitude which is receding. We are pushing hard against it, but it remains a difficulty in making complementarity effective as an argument for the court.
Well, we are talking about the International Criminal Court, the ICC, and our guests are John L. Washburn, Ambassador Christian Venevaeser, and Ambassador Stephen Rapp, and we'll get some more callers in after this very short break. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Philadelphia Live Arts and Philly Fringe supports WHYY and presents its 16th annual Contemporary Arts Festival, now through September 22nd, featuring local and international theater, dance, music, and visual art events. Spotlight shows include Red Eye to Haverty Grace, an inventive work by Lucidity Suitcase Intercontinental that follows the mysterious last days of Edgar Allan Poe, and Food Court, an experimental piece from Australia's visionary back-to-back theater. Details and tickets at livearts.org.
I believe.
Actor Andrew Rannells originated the role of Elder Price in the Broadway musical The Book of Mormon, and he played Elijah, Hannah's former boyfriend, in HBO's Girls. Now he's co-starring in the new sitcom The New Normal, created by Ryan Murphy, who also created Glee. Andrew Rannells on the next Fresh Air. Join us.
This afternoon at 3, and again tonight at 7 on WHYY. unique artistic voice will play out at the Kimmel this month by a theatrical ensemble perceived to have intellectual disabilities. The performance, called Food Court, is a take on our culture's obsession with perfection that opens audiences' eyes to shame and the unfulfilled desires of individuals who are marginalized by their differences. On the next Voices in the Family with Dan Gottlieb, gaining a richer understanding and clearer view of those with intellectual disabilities. Today at noon, here on WHYY-FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking about the International Criminal Court, which is based in The Hague, established to prosecute the perpetrators of war crimes, genocide, and crimes against humanity. We are evaluating some of the successes and failures of the ICC, looking at its track record, wondering whether it's made the world a safer, more peaceful place, and also talking about the U.S. relationship with the ICC, and we'll be talking about the future of the court as well. And again, a quick recap here, talking with John L. Washburn, convener for the American Non-Governmental Organizations Coalition for the International Criminal Court, Ambassador Christian Venevaeser, permanent representative of Liechtenstein to the UN, and former president of the Assembly of States Parties of the ICC, and Ambassador Stephen Rapp, who leads the U.S. State Department's Office of Global Criminal Justice. And we have one or two open lines at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Karoma from Philadelphia to join us. Go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Yes, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Good, I'm from Sierra Leone. And my question is, there's no doubt that Charles Taylor and Ellie Johnson Sirleaf of Liberia, who is the president, created the war from Liberia into Sierra Leone. Why was Charles Taylor tried for war crime? And Ellie Johnson Sirleaf is now president of Liberia, and in the good book of the ICC and United States of America. Thank you.
You're welcome. And I'm going to put that to you, Stephen Rapp.
Well, I mean, what we had with Charles Taylor was his active support, aiding and abetting and planning the attacks on Sierra Leone in 98 and 99. At that time, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf was not even in Liberia. She'd run against Taylor in 97 and been defeated. There are those that have asserted in Liberia that because she supported Taylor in about 1990, when he first started his revolt against the Doe government, she bore some responsibility for what he did later, but she quickly broke with him. And in terms of the greatest responsibility, which is the people that we go after, we're talking about individuals that are actively out there causing these mass crimes over the course of weeks and months and years. And that's why Charles Taylor was indicted, as were the leaders of the various armed groups that committed the atrocities on the ground against the people of Sierra Leone.
To you, Christian Venevaeser, what is the punishment if someone is found guilty of a war crime under the ICC? What is their punishment? We've talked about reparations a bit, but what is the punishment for that individual?
Well, there is no there is no death penalty under the Rome Statute, as there is an emerging norm in international law that the death penalty is outlawed. There was no death penalty in the Rwanda Tribunal Statute, in the Yugoslavia Tribunal Statute either. So a life sentence is the highest possible sentence, and then obviously it depends on how the judges do assess assess the case. Anything below is, of course, also possible.
Let me get, looks like Fran from Fort Washington to join us on Radio Times. And Fran, go ahead, you're on the air.
Yes, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I was wondering, I understand the issues regarding the United States and and the jurisdiction of the ICC, but is there any possibility that in the future Cheney, Bush, and Rumsfeld could be prosecuted for war crimes regarding the war in Iraq?
Under the ICC, Fran?
Under the ICC, and what would the relationship be between American court system and the ICC? It's very frustrating that that preemptive strike took place, and I believe it's been a turning point in the history of the United States. That was allowed to happen, and the consequences have been just devastating.
Well, friend, let me see what John Washburn has to say. John?
This is a question I get quite often in my work across the country, and I understand your frustration and your feelings about this. First of all, as Ambassador Venevieser has said, the United States is not a state party to the court and was not a state party at the time that these situations occurred with Bush and Cheney and the others that you mentioned. Also, at that time, Iraq was not a state party either. So for those reasons, the court does not have a basis for jurisdiction over those individuals, much as many people like yourself would like to see that happen. I'd like to say, simply as one American citizen to another, that even if the ICC were to have jurisdiction, I think it extremely important that the feelings of people like yourself should be expressed through our judicial system rather than turning to an international tribunal. We have the capacity to do it. We have the courts to do it. It's a question of citizens' will to make it happen.
Anyone else want to add to that?
No, I think it's I'll just give the legal answer. It's really unequivocal situation. The International Criminal Court does not have jurisdiction over it. And I really agree on everything else with John.
What about that?
And an issue here, and it gets us into one of Christian's issues. I know the complaint, I think, of our listener was that the war was started preemptorily and that they didn't have the right to go into Iraq. The ICC doesn't presently have jurisdiction over those kinds of questions, how wars start. It deals with how they're fought and deals with whether they're fought by intentionally attacking civilians or going after political or ethnic groups, or even to the point of the commission of a genocide against a racial or sectarian group. And so that's where the ICC deals with the situation. There are those that want to move it forward and have it look at question of whether the crime of aggression can be prosecuted, and that's something that the ICC will be deciding by 2017.
Did you want to add to that?
Just to comment on that. As Steve has said, it may be possible for the International Criminal Court to prosecute the crime of aggression, but no earlier than 2017. So crime of aggression is essentially the illegal use of force. We made a historic decision on this at the review conference in Kampala in 2010. We now need 30 states to ratify the agreement from Kampala, and then the regime can be activated, and I think that would be a watershed, really, in the history of international law, because you could criminalize the illegal use of force for the first time since Nuremberg.
Interesting. Let me go back to you, Stephen Rapp, and this is really a personal question, because you were prosecutor of the Special Court for Sierra Leone. You served as a senior trial attorney, chief of prosecutions at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. And we know about the kind of mass atrocities that took place in those two particular countries. What was it like for you to be part of those tribunals, be part of those court processes?
Well, it was an extremely challenging but very satisfying experience. I mean, it's intensely difficult to develop the evidence in these situations. I mean, you deal with victims, people who were killed, you know, were in churchyards where thousands of people were killed, where their own children's bodies were in front of them, and who managed to survive and saw some of what went on. You also have to find individuals that are themselves implicated, that can give you information on the chain of command and how this all occurred, and you have to be able to convince them to testify, and then you have to deal with it in really a new area of the law where it's not just enough to prove that there was a murder, not just enough to prove that it was a rape. You have to prove its connection to an armed conflict or its connection to a genocide intent, and so it's an incredibly challenging experience, and you do it before judges that come from all over the world, from defense attorneys and fellow prosecutors that come from different traditions, and you have to sort of iron out these differences in each of the cases. But it's immensely satisfying when you succeed. I tried the media trial in Arusha, the first case against the radio, against the two principals of hate radio. People remember it maybe from the Hotel Rwanda movie, inciting people that kill Tutsis, kill the cockroaches, and we were able to convict the two leaders of that radio and also the publisher of a newspaper for direct and public incitement to commit genocide. And it was certainly the most satisfying moment of my life the day that the judges came back in December of 2003 with those historic verdicts. And it was for the victims who also told me that it meant so much to them.
And it tells us something about Rwanda, does it not? I mean, that Rwanda was able to host these trials, in a sense?
Well, Rwanda was able to cooperate very closely with the court. I mean, our investigations were there, even though our trials were in Arusha. I spent, when it was over in Rwanda, dozens of times in villages and hills talking to the victims and also in other African countries where people had sought refuge who were associated with the perpetrators. And but it was possible to do that, to bring now 80, I think we've completed 82 trials, there's just one left that's been tried in Arusha, and to establish a justice. And by the way, these accused that we charged, they had chased off to 26 different countries, and we were able to bring them using the power of the United Nations and diplomatic pressure from countries as varied as the United States to Zambia.
Mm. Let me get Ellen from Haverford to join us on Radio Times. Ellen, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I wish I could make this more sophisticated, but my question is, where do you get your body of laws? Clearly, the things you describe are repugnant, but what makes them illegal?
It's actually a terrific question, Ellen. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Can I put that first to you, Tom Washburn?
Yes, thank you. These laws have been developing for a long time. They started out as non-binding, non-mandatory principles and standards of behavior for states. Over time at the UN and in the development of international law, these turned into treaties. Of course, in the case of war crimes, the history of war crimes conventions and law goes well back into the 19th century, and the United States played a very major role at the time of the American Civil War in codifying that. So we have treaties subscribed to by countries that deal with war crimes and genocide. The Genocide Treaty goes back to 1948. On the question of crimes against humanity, although this was not yet reduced to a formal convention, a great deal of research and effort had gone into defining crimes against humanity, again in terms of states. And so when the negotiators for the Rome Statute sat down together, they had this body of established law, the law that almost everybody, all countries in the world agreed applied to states. The work of the creators of the court of the Rome Statute was to turn this established law for states into a form that judges could apply to individuals in trials. Obviously, it's a very different matter to apply a standard to the behavior of a state where you have no institution to do that from applying a norm or a standard to an individual who is being tried in a formal process inside a judicial institution. That was a major achievement of the Rome Statute. And what and so with a treaty, taking that law negotiated over a long period of time painfully by the nations of the world and having it adopted by 120 countries in a formal meeting in Rome, that's where the law came from.
Go ahead.
Our body of law is the Rome Statute. You don't have to look far. It's on the internet. You don't have to go to any different sources. It is just the Rome Statute. But what John has said is extremely important. Nothing new was invented in the Rome Statute. We just put together the law as it existed before and made it work, beginning from the Genocide Convention to the Geneva Conventions and so on. But you just have to look at the Rome Statute, nothing else.
But if you have countries like Syria, who you mentioned is not a state party, mm-hmm. the U.S., we've been talking about China, Russia. I mean, it seems to me there are holes in the ICC because of the fact that not everyone has signed on to it.
That's correct, but that's not a hole really in the law. Right. I mean, Syria is a party to the Genocide Convention, as far as I know. Syria certainly is a party to the Geneva Convention, so these laws do apply. What does not apply there is that the ICC does have jurisdiction over the people that commit those crimes. But you're making a very good point. It is extremely important, and it is our goal to have everybody join the ICC, from the U.S. to everybody else. It will take time, but it will come.
And let me just add here in this that obviously when we established the Yugoslavia and the Rwanda tribunals, we did it after the crimes, and it was based on the fact that this law was out there, that it existed. There just weren't courts to enforce it. And so unlike the ICC that has a very specific treaty, it is also true that as a matter of international law, the Geneva Conventions, the Genocide Convention, and also the sort of customary common law of crimes against humanity are globally recognized. And if you deal with crimes against humanity and you want to see the legal authority to that, you go back to Nuremberg, where the Nazis and Count Four of the mm-hmm. in the Great Trial were tried for crimes against humanity. That on that basis, they were held responsible for the Holocaust, those that were convicted of that crime, and were able to look back at those precedents in prosecuting these cases. A crime against humanity, by the way, is a crime against the civilian population done on a widespread or systematic basis, and usually with an ethnic or racial or political sort of animus, and there's well-established law in that area that we are able to turn to in the tribunal. The advantage in the ICC is they've written it down in very specific terms, and now there can be no question for anyone that's prosecuted there what the law is.
Unfair question. We have 10 seconds. The future of the ICC as you see it?
Well, I think the ICC has a bright future if we make it work. It's extremely important that we as states make it work. We have to make it work politically, diplomatically, but also through cooperation and through arrests in particular.
Well, on that note, my thanks to all three of our guests, Ambassador Christian Veneveser, John L. Washburn, and Ambassador Stephen Rapp. They will be this afternoon at the Free Library of Philadelphia from 2 until 6, and this is part of the Philadelphia Global Initiative on the Rule of Laws Conference, carrying on a conversation that we began here on the radio. Go to WHYY.org/radiotimes to find out more about this program. And if you go to our Facebook page, you can see what our guests look like. Stay with us. We'll be right back.